And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today, we stop all the speculation about global warming and head on off to an American community that feels the lashing waves of a warming earth lapping at their front doors, literally. Over the past 25 years, the Alaskan community of Shishmaref has watched the 300-foot buffer that protected them from the impact of raging storm waters disappear. Despite efforts to barricade themselves from the oceans, there is no more land left, and now time, too, has run out. Today, we talk with Lucy Inengwak, an Alaskan native and American citizen whose town is being forced to relocate to higher ground. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? And does it even matter if I sing? If I sink, if I sink or swim.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As I put today's show together, I came across the news that Don Herbert had passed away at age 89. Most of you probably won't recognize the name Don Herbert right away, but most of you will recognize the legendary Mr. Wizard. It's strange. When I heard this, I felt a true sense of loss come over my body. I was surprised that I felt my tear ducts swell, but of course, being a real guy of 58, didn't actually shed that tear. But my age is telling as it relates to Mr. Wizard, because as a small boy growing up in the 1950s, I was one of the hundreds of thousands of kids who would tune in each Saturday to watch Mr. Wizard. And I realized almost immediately that what I do on the Wild Side News almost certainly is my own form of tribute to Mr. Wizard. Like Mr. Wizard, I've wanted to present the issues of nature and the environment with science as the backdrop. Like Mr. Wizard, I try to talk and discuss and explore and steer away from the razzmatazz and the silliness and slick sound bites that permeate everything in the media these days. And I realized this is all due to a style that respects reason, intelligence, and honors our inborn curiosity. Don Herbert, Mr. Wizard, thanks for all you've given me, and the hundreds of thousands of middle-aged science boys and girls who retain our youthful sense of wonder, which you gently enkindled into each of us many years ago. There's a chance the world may never again have time to think and wonder as Mr. Wizard so magically did with us each week. And that just may be the greatest loss of all in this thrumming ahead world. If ever we could recreate that wondrous age of innocence again, well, we're long past that. My life as a biologist, educator, and science media host, I owe so directly to Don Herbert. Thanks, Mr. Wizard. In just a few moments, we'll be heading up to Shishmaref, Alaska, to visit with Lucy Inengwak, whose people are making plans to head to higher ground as they watch this American town melt away due to global warming. But first, we bring you this week's edition of the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. This is your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and we continue to get updates from our exceptional panel of experts in science, advocacy, and nature. The world is a complex place, as you'll certainly learn in the upcoming news report. And those of us who work and dedicate our lives to keeping this whole thing going sometimes need to take a look at that age-old question, do the ends justify the means? It's a value judgment, but a newly activating advocate is taking a personal stand to do the right thing. So I want to begin today's summit with Ben Lowe. Ben?
I've got a confession. I love to travel. I love going to new places, experiencing cultures, meeting people. I've hopped an airplane for about 6 round trips each year in college. Last summer, I flew over to Tanzania. There's nothing unusual about this. My generation really gets around. We now have unprecedented access to all parts of the globe, and we've taken advantage of these opportunities. We'll hop a plane at the slightest excuse. This summer, one of my roommates is in Russia, the other's in the West Bank. I have friends and classmates that are in almost any country you can think of, even places like Sudan and Tibet. But we really need to rethink this travel happy trend, and it needs to start with me. First off, I need to figure out how to cut back on all this flying. Really cut back. Then I need to consolidate meetings and road trips so that they accomplish more on less energy. When possible, I need to take trains or buses. As an environmentalist, I am convicted that it's time for me to clean up my own act and set a good example. After all, it sure seems hypocritical to be burning up the earth by flying to a meeting to talk about saving the earth.
Thanks, Ben. And in that same vein, I'm proud to announce that the weekly Earth Summit has one of the lowest carbon footprints of any global forum, as our guests travel here and speak to you each week without having to even drive a tenth of a mile to do so. Now that's keeping our eye on the message. And speaking of eyes, I recently talked with Dr. Mark Beckhoff about the power of eye contact in communicating with animals, and Mark has offered to share his observations. Dr. Beckhoff.
One of the things you mentioned about that interaction is eye contact, and I think that that is very, very important. You know, sometimes you can invite interaction, and other ways you could repel it by direct staring of the eyes. But I think when you relax your eyes and you roll them around and sometimes you move your head very slowly, that also is an invitation to interact friendly. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a play signal. But that's another thing I've done with cats, is especially with cats who I don't know, basically you could look at them, you can break eye contact, you can roll your eyes around and certainly not stare them directly head on. And it's fascinating how you can get them to do that.
We're going to keep up our dialogue on animals and their wonderful abilities with Dr. Beckhoff in the months ahead. Animals and their amazing diversity and behaviors has a champion in Dr. Robin D. Moore with Conservation International, who invites you to join him in his efforts to awaken the world to the plight of the amphibians. Please welcome Dr. Moore.
New Zealand contains only 4 living species of frogs. 3 species have already gone extinct. Those surviving species are among the world's most ancient amphibians, having remained virtually unchanged for around 200 million years. They are unusual in that they communicate using chemicals and only have limited hearing ability. They very rarely swim, but when they do not kick their legs in time like most frogs. These frogs are restricted to small areas of native forest in the North Island of New Zealand. They are, like a third of amphibians around the world, threatened with extinction. The good news is that they're the subject of an intensive conservation effort, which is having some success at reversing trends. An awareness-raising campaign is informing the public about these bizarre creatures, and the creation of reserves and habitat restoration is protecting their habitat. As a result of these efforts, a new population of one species has been found, and other populations do appear to be expanding. These successes speak to the value of a truly collaborative effort among scientists, zoos, and local groups, and serve as a model for projects elsewhere. To learn more about this and other amphibian news, you can read Froglog, the bi-monthly newsletter of the Amphibian Specialist Group. This is available at www.amphibians.org.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Please do visit his website. If you've not ventured into the wonders of the amphibians, it's definitely time you did. We're always pleased to hear from Dr. Charles Kennel. This week, Dr. Kennel applies his penetrating perspective to remind us all that there are no simple answers. Dr. Kennel.
I think the most important thing is that if you are worried about the next 100 years on our planet, then you'll need to predict how our global environment is going to evolve. And the minute you do that, you begin to understand how interconnected all the parts of the Earth system are. You can start any place in the Earth system and go around the loop. The oceans transport heat from the tropics to the poles, and that this ocean transport of heat is one of the major drivers of climate. Some of this energy gets into the atmosphere and powers the storms and the freshwater cycle. The sun shines down on the oceans and atmospheres and warms them and is the ultimate driver of climate. The parts and pieces are tied together. And when we start interacting with the climate, we do so on a global and interconnected basis. When we put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide, it spreads completely around the Earth and blends in with the contributions of everybody else on the planet who are burning fossil fuels. And this carbon dioxide then heats the globe. On an average basis, the temperature is rising 1 or 2 tenths of a degree per decade. But that masks the interconnectedness of the parts of the climate. Some parts of the world are going to get drier. Others, particularly the tropics, may get wetter. There will be more energy circulating in the climate system. People now think that while the number of storms may remain approximately the same, they will probably get more intense over time. As we warm the surface of the Earth, the glaciers are retreating, the snow melts in our mountains are retreating, and the snow cover is retreating. And we're affecting the freshwater cycle through the melting of ice. The melting of freshwater that has been on land, such as in Greenland and Antarctica, when that gets into the ocean, that is beginning to contribute to the rise of sea level. When sea level rises, our coastal environments and our beaches and our beachside cliffs and our homes become more vulnerable. And it isn't only the few centimeter per decade sea level rise that we've seen that makes all the difference. It's when the sea level rises in the background and great storms cause storm surges to go across our land. I was just in England, and a good deal of London is only 2 or 3 meters above sea level. And so we have chosen to build much of our civilization next to the sea. 50% of the world population lives within 100 miles of the ocean. And so most of our human activity is taking place just where the sea is about to encroach on all that we have done. When we burn fossil fuels and other fuels inefficiently, we create smog and aerosol particles. And the natural winds pick them up, and they transport them across the ocean. When there's a major smog event in Beijing, it arrives off the coast of California. About a week or so later, we can detect all of those particles in our atmosphere, and at those times, they are three-quarters of California's upper air pollution. When the winds blow off the desert, in Africa, and they transport sand and dust to the islands of Jamaica, there's a rise in pulmonary diseases and asthma. And so our entire world is interconnected in ways that we had no idea until we started studying it at the Earth system as a whole in the last 50 years. And it is clear to us that nature has created a greater interconnection amongst its parts than we have as a human civilization. And it's the fracturing of our civilization and the lack of communication and understanding and the inequality around the world that gets in the way of our being able to stabilize the environment of this great planet so that we can live on it as a harmonious civilization for centuries to come. Nature is more integrated and more tied together than we are.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. I look forward to hearing from you each week here on the Weekly Earth Summit. Sometimes it's hard to know if we're making enough progress to meet these challenges. We're all glad to know that the faith-based communities are awakening to a renewed sense of responsibility to care for the gift of life on Earth in its broadest sense. Dr. Matthew Sleeth announces a personal milestone on his path to serve God and save the planet. Matthew?
The big change for me is now being the U.S. director of this Christians in Conservation. Arosha, which is capital A, capital R-O-C-H-A. Arosha means the rock in Portuguese. And the tagline has always been Christians in Conservation. In the United States, we're moving the tagline to be the title, Christians in Conservation. It's in 16 countries, and there's like three or four more pending right at the moment. But it's everywhere from Kenya to Brazil to India to UK, Canada, United States. In the U.S., it developed as a way to send money to the other Arosha sites around the world. But there wasn't really a vision for what it was going to do here. In other countries, it does a lot of field biology work. They rescue estuaries, things like that. And in the United States, there's some of that going on. There's a project in Washington State. The blueberry crops are being decimated by starlings. And one of the Arosha scientists figured out that you can use kestrels, which are really territorial, to chase off the starlings and not have to use any poisons and that sort of thing. And in the U.S., they've had a board. They've had great members and lots of very generous people, but they haven't had somebody with a vision of where it should go in the U.S. I've taken up the job of leading that organization in the United States, and there's just great people with a great vision, and they love to combine science and conservation and their faith of Christianity. And that's what's up and new with me, and it's a challenge, but it's a wonderful challenge. And I get emails from all over the world now, people, you know, pulling for us and praying for us here. And that's encouraging to realize how big this family that not only shares my faith, but my love of the creation is.
Many people are joining this effort to serve the Earth for various reasons. Some because they've sensed the need. Some because they're becoming adults and the world is theirs if they can keep it. To them, and to all of us, there is so much to learn. Dave Foreman now joins us to offer his years of devoted study and focus his attention on a great new book about wilderness. Dave?
I'm going to be a little different this week and give a book review. I'm a great lover of conservation books. I have about 3,000 in my library. And on the Rewilding website, rewilding.org, we have a feature called Books of the Big Outside, where I give short reviews of the most important conservation books around. We have about 350 books listed right now. And I also do Uncle Dave's six-pack of the best books recently. And for last year, 2006, the book that won the best conservation book of 2006, in my opinion, was The Last Great Wilderness, the campaign to establish the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by Roger Kay. I envy my friend Roger Kay. As a wilderness manager and the bush pilot for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, he has had wilderness experiences most of the rest of us can only dream about. Knowing our flagship wilderness in all seasons and moods has led him into thinking deeply, perhaps more deeply than any living person, about the host of values wilderness holds. Roger's deep exploration of wilderness values comes through in The Last Great Wilderness. I read the book on a three-week canoe trip in the Arctic Refuge last year and was mightily impressed. In a short review such as this, I cannot begin to do justice to the book. But let me point out just several features of the book that make it a standout. Arctic Wilderness is the detailed history of the decade-long campaign in the 1950s to set aside a big chunk of northeastern Alaska as some kind of wilderness preserve. In recounting that history, Roger plumbs the values that captivated and drove the various conservationists, giving us the most intelligent and thoughtful review of wilderness values in print. Conservation histories too often focus on the same cast of well-known, to literate conservationists anyway, characters. For example, Olus and Marty Murie are seen just about by everyone as the leaders and key players in that campaign for the Arctic. Roger gives the Muries their due, but brings out the other worthies of the campaign, too, particularly Lowell Sumner and George Collins of the National Park Service, the two greatest conservationists of the 20th century that you never heard of. And beyond the big players, Roger gives grassroots activists center stage. Quoting extensively from them, he shows that Alaskans, like bush pilots Jenny Wood and Celia Hunter, were original wilderness thinkers who didn't need to rely on experts. And he shows that hunters in Alaska in the lower 48 were a significant force behind protection. Roger also gives a fair portrayal of the opponents of protection, insightfully showing how the opponents and supporters use competing concepts of the last frontier to bolster their arguments. In order to showcase such views, Roger's research involved reading personal letters, hearing records, letters to the editor, and conducting interviews with still living folks on all sides. What interested me most, though, was how Roger discussed values. Evolution was the key thing to be protected in the eyes of Sumner and Collins. They and others saw that only an immense wild region could protect the ongoing process of evolution and all of its building blocks. Quote, Sumner expressed the hope that this place might always have, quote, freedom to continue, unhindered and forever if we are willing, the particular story of planet Earth unfolding here, where its native creatures can still have freedom to pursue their future, so distant, so mysterious. Do read The Last Great Wilderness.
Be sure to check out Dave's critique of over 300 books about nature and the environment on the Rewilding website at www.rewilding.org. We're happy to announce that this weekly convocation of conservationists was brought to you in an effort to prove that great things can and do happen in a carbon-friendly way. This is Sidney Wildsmith inviting you to join us next week when we reconvene here for your weekly Earth Summit. There's a chance the story you're about to hear may contain images and ideas that are uncomfortable for many to comprehend. However, you'd better get used to it, because
here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? Does it even matter? If I sink, if I sink, if I sink or swim.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Have you ever been in a truly frightening situation where you felt that you'd rather be somewhere else than where you are right now? Well, to the unfortunate people of Shishmaref, Alaska, that is now a way of life. What's amazing is that the story you are about to hear is happening in an American town, a village of 600 people who have lived in their place for thousands of years until now, as the rising dangers from global warming wash away their land and their connection to it. Join us now as we head on up to the western coast to the island people of Shishmaref, Alaska, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Shishmaref, Alaska, just may be the first American town forced to head to higher ground as a direct result of global warming. Following today's Nature News update, we talk with Lucy Iningawak as she shares an uncertain future for herself and her people. That's coming up, but first, the news. That Okefenokee swamp fire that managed to spread into Florida and continues to burn as we speak is now the largest wildfire in U.S. history since 1918. Following a couple of days of heavy rainfall, hopes are this 600,000-acre inferno may be coming to an end. Although wildfires are a natural part of the natural cycles of nature, some suggest that a fire of this magnitude in the eastern United States may be indicative of the effects of a warming world. Delegates from 171 nations convened at the UN Wildlife Conference meeting in The Hague this week and continued to promote two opposing solutions to the illegal trade in elephant ivory, which is closing in on a four-nation deal that just may permit the sale of 140 tons of ivory in the year ahead. That's 140 tons. This comes from the conference meeting known as CITES, C-I-T-E-S, or the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Primarily focused on African interests, two countries, Kenya and Mali, asked for a 20-year moratorium on ivory sales, stating that over 19,000 elephants were illegally killed by poachers this year, with much of the ivory being sold to good old Japan, which was allowed a one-time purchase of 60 tons of ivory. Meanwhile, the nations of Botswana, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa claim that keeping the ivory trade open will serve elephant populations well, as monies earned can be used for conservation projects. Meanwhile, thousands and thousands of elephants, enough to supply 140 tons of ivory a year, continue to die, legally and illegally. And in India, tigers in reserves just keep on disappearing at an alarming rate to meet the demands of the illegal trade in tiger parts. Recent studies on tiger populations in the Buxa Tiger Reserve indicate that the numbers had plummeted from 31 last year to 6 this year. This follows on the shocking discovery that within the popular Sarska Tiger Reserve, there are no more tigers at all, following their being wiped out in 2005. And it is good to remember that there were an estimated 40,000 tigers in India 100 years ago. In 2001, the population was estimated to be 3,700. That number may be wildly misleading if these horrific illegal takings continue at their current pace. And like the tigers of India, the orangutans of Indonesia are falling like so many statistics as loss of habitat, poaching, and illegal collecting hit the orangutans directly. Recent estimates state that 7,000 Sumatran orangutans and 50,000 Borneo orangutans exist in the world, but as we are learning so painfully, the numbers are crashing with each new census. With illegal logging somehow continuing and an astonishing 88% of all logging in Indonesia, there is little doubt that the plight of the orangutan will likely not even be considered in the years ahead in the $4 to $5 billion a year illegal taking of lumber. Caribbean and Central American sea turtles are swimming in troubled waters too, as all 6 species are endangered or critically endangered. Caught for their shells, meat, and eggs, the turtles are being taken, often illegally, in increasing numbers. A recent report stated, for example, that essentially all eggs laid in Guatemala had been taken by humans. That does not bode well for the future of sea turtles. The host of the Wildside News announced this week that if these trends continue, the world is headed for what could be a very serious wreckage of the fabric of life. He stated that the illegal taking of the wild creatures has reached pandemic levels and that people concerned about their welfare, health, and happiness, and their children's future as well, need to unite to stop it. and he urges the people of Japan in particular to fix whatever it is about their society that seems to be so numb to whole regions of spirit as to continue to permit such wanton takings from the dwindling wealth of wonder. And in the U.S., the BLM has approved extensive oil and gas leases in the environmentally sensitive Roan Plateau in western Colorado, despite the objections of Colorado's governor and members from its congressional delegations. Drilling is expected to begin next year, and it has been ruled that all leases must be drilled by a single oil and gas operator. And who is that operator? It will be a big operator. And finally, when you think about human history, how far back do you generally consider? Some will easily count backwards 2,000 years to the time of Christ and the Romans. Others will continue counting backwards to China and Babylon and Ur, perhaps 5,000 and 6,000 years or so. New Agers and other psychic speculators will point to references of Atlantis and Mu, say, 10,000 years ago, when the glaciers melted and probably sank thousands of cities around the world. And anthropologists will point to Clovis Man at 11,000 BC, and even some early cave tools at 20,000 BC. Well, that was then, and this is pre-then. Scientists have discovered prehistoric shells in Morocco, with holes drilled for stringing onto bracelets and necklaces and possibly colored with red ochre dating from 82,000 years BC. As we debate our fate due to global warming, human greed, a divine plan, or just the way things are, let us realize, although it may be small consolation, that this has all occurred thousands and thousands of times before. And that's the news. A few reminders. Next week, I'm happy to announce that we'll be bringing you an update on a story I did over 3 years ago. It is perhaps one of the most explicit proofs of the communion we can share with another species. Be sure to tune in next week as we get an update from David Ball and his canine companion, Hawk. And please keep spreading the news about the Wild Side News. Send out an email today, even while you listen, with a link to www.wildsidenews.com. Thanks. And now on to today's feature. A lot of people talk about global warming. It's becoming a much bigger issue around the planet. But for most people, it's just something we talk about. We have little signs of it here and there, or major signs, depending on your perspective. But the truth is, on this planet, there are people who are being affected by global warming. And so now we're traveling up to Alaska, very far north, to a village, the village of Shishmaref. And joining us now from Shishmaref is an elder there and a resident, Lucy Iningawuk. Lucy, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Tell us what you can about Shishmaref. This is a native village that goes back many hundreds of years. What can you tell us about your people and your history there?
It dates back thousands of years, and it has several sites, that community down at the west end and on the east end and currently in the center of the island.
Is that part of the legacy that is discussed amongst the elders and others that they pass on to their children?
Yes, they told us stories of what might happen in the future.
And those stories were really quite interesting in terms of what may happen to the seas. Can you share some of those?
Yeah, there was an airport being built in the 60s, and it went right from the ocean side to the lagoon side. And that was our first airport, and one of the elders at that time in the 60s stated that it'll eventually turn into a river from one side to the other.
And did that happen?
It hasn't yet. It's still, majority of it's still intact, but a lot of the edges are gone.
It's going to be an interesting discussion because Shishmaref is trying to determine what to do. Why don't you share with the listeners what is happening to Shishmaref and what your experience has been throughout the years? When did you first sense that something dramatic was happening to the island?
I think it's started in the 70s, early 70s, when we had our first, when I first saw a storm in Chishma. We've never seen parts of the land just going away with the ocean. This was in 1973 when my grandmother was still alive.
You were on the island at that time?
Yes, we were on that island at that time, and the waves were really huge. I've never seen them that.
How big would you say they were?
Like 5-foot swells or more.
Mm-hmm.
And after that storm, they didn't know how to protect the island, so they tried sandbags and, oh no, they tried 55-gallon drums along the edge of the bluffs over where it was hit the most.
The population of the island is around 500, between 500 and 600 at this time.
I think we were like 300 then, because we average about 20 new babies a year now.
Uh-huh.
So we're about over 600.
Uh-huh. One of the things that is a big issue is the fact that you make your living, it's a subsistence living to a large degree, by relying on the ocean for much of your food. Why don't you discuss the significance of sea ice? Because a lot of the problems that you're experiencing right now have to do with the fact that the sea ice is changing so dramatically.
We've seen a real dramatic change this year. Usually by May, month of May, we have our main subsistence season started, but we have finally gotten, this is in June now, yesterday we finally get an ukuk, it's a bearded seal that our people use year-round for to sustain us.
The ugruk, is that how you say it?
Yes.
The hooded
yes,
seal.
Yes, uh-huh. It's a bearded seal, and they finally catch one. Usually in May we catch our enough for the winter, but we finally caught one yesterday. The ice is just staying around Shishmaref and can't seem to go away.
The ice isn't going away?
I know, it's real thin and rotten, but it's just hanging on.
Well, now, in terms of the ugruk, the hooded seals, how would you traditionally hunt for them?
Traditionally, they use dog team and go out in the ice and hunt them. At that time, when I was growing up, they were using rifles then. And now they're using boats, smaller boats, to go out there. And they're finally able to go out yesterday, so we're back.
Because I'm not there and I'm not a seal hunter. I know in some cases people hunt by waiting for them to surface through holes, through the ice. Is that what you would do, or would it be more like you were hunting the seals on the surface of the ice?
They're usually either on top, or when they use boats, they just catch them when they show their head up from the water.
Now, I know in the past, for years, you used to use snowmobiles to head out onto the sea ice. And I understand that that's becoming impossible or dangerous.
Yes, right now. The ice conditions, they're really not for snow machines. It depends on the ice conditions.
So now, because the ice is so thin, you're having to use boats as opposed to either dog sled or snowmobiles. You've had to abandon those approaches to catching the seal?
For this year, prior years, they used snowmobiles.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hardly use dog teams anymore, except for us.
We're going to go back a little bit and talk about how your island and your people are being hit. There was the big storm back in 1973, and that storm took out a significant portion of the island. I know that I've looked at, for example, images of the houses there. And how far away was the ocean at that time from your houses?
Probably about 200 feet, maybe 200-300.
That was back in 1973.
Yeah.
And then with that big storm, how much of that land disappeared?
About half of it, about 150 feet.
Wow, from one storm.
Mm-hmm.
And what time of the year was that?
Fall time.
Fall?
Fall time, yes.
Well, since that time, your shoreline has been decreasing, and why don't you discuss where things are now in terms of the houses and some of that history?
After the 1997, I think, we had to move 18 homes that were endangered by the ocean, the waves. We had to move them to the old airport and to get them out of harm's way.
Because the land had literally been eaten up almost to the edges of those houses, right to the houses themselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And the sand is so fine, it just melts with the ocean water and disappears.
Right, and we'll talk about that too, and that's the permafrost. How are things today? Because 97 was about 10 years ago. Now what's the status? How much of the land has disappeared since that time from the oceans?
They're encroaching to our own residential homes, which used to be like nothing to worry about in the 70s.
Right, because you had that 200-foot buffer. But now they're literally almost at your back door.
Yeah.
I have to believe that that has to be a very frightening situation for you and your people. I would think that you live in fear that another storm could conceivably really, really devastate and perhaps even kill people.
I hope we don't get to that.
I agree with you. But that is a fear of yours. I mean, it's a real fear of yours, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What do real people do, like yourself, in that situation? What are your options at this point?
Our options are to try to keep our families and people together.
There certainly is talk of the fact that you can't. You feel as if it isn't safe necessarily to stay at Shishmaref any longer.
Yes, we just need the time to have the community select a site that they could relocate to, and we want to remain together in the Bay of Shishma.
Mm-hmm. The island itself lies about 5 miles off of the mainland. Are you looking at places along the mainland to relocate to higher ground?
Yeah, we have two potential sites that had soil studies done. We had east soil studies from all the way from the west side to the mainland and then on to the east side, and there were 9 sites that were studied that would be adequate enough for us to move to, and there was 2 sites that the soil studies findings were good enough for us to move to.
How does the village discuss this? How do you actually talk about that and sort of how do you make a decision? That's a very dramatic decision.
The entities in Shishmaref, they formed a Shishmaref Erosion and Relocation Coalition, which consists of the native village of Shishmaref, the Shishmaref City Council, Shishmaref Native Corporation, and kind of combine all the entities that provide service to our people in various ways and combine the efforts and form the coalition to combat our cause in trying to find a safer, more stable site to move our people. And there was a vote in 2004 to relocate the community. We did a vote in the community.
That's a difficult thing to do. It takes a lot of money. You're one of the first true villages that is feeling the need to have to move because of global warming. How does it make you feel about this situation, and to what degree do you sense that the world should help you out?
I think our people want to remain together, and that's our number one reason why we're trying to move more inland, to remain together as one people, rather than being dispersed to other communities.
You would have to, at that point, just literally abandon your homes and your lands, and then somehow, I'm just trying to figure out how that's done. Are people suggesting that you may be given land, or would you have to purchase land? I mean, you have to abandon your literal land and your homes. How do you do that financially? What's the strategy there?
The potential relocation site is within the Shishmaref Native land.
Uh-huh.
So it's not really an issue here.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Yeah, that helps. But then you have to build as well.
Yeah.
How soon do you expect that you may have to do that?
Well, we had projected at least a good 15 years in the early 80s. So we're attempting to work on securing the site with other agencies that work with us. Mm-hmm. In the region.
Well, now let's talk about personally. I try to put myself in your position and try to imagine how it would make me feel to have to abandon my land, my home, and move to another place. I mean, I don't exactly know how I would feel about that. So I'm curious how you feel about that and what people in Shishmaref are saying about this whole situation.
I feel that it would be keep our community together. This island is really getting very small, enough to where we don't have any more space to provide for our children that are becoming adults to. There's no suitable sites for them to build their homes here, so going more inland would provide that for our children.
Well, that's very interesting. In that sense, it could be, although it's painful and difficult, it may be just time for that, for your people to expand and to feel more comfortable in their place. In terms of the Shishmaref and what is happening, has there been a sense of sort of being, what shall I say, attacked by nature, attacked by the seas, the sense of insecurity as a way of life?
Yeah, we can feel it every day.
Every day.
Especially now in this time of the year, we're kind of not really into the ocean melting.
I know that because it's a 5 mile distance between the mainland and Shishmaref, if there were a major storm, you'd be in a very difficult situation, because you couldn't literally head off the island to protect yourself.
We just have to make do with what we have here, I think, to try to protect all our people here.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting. It's very challenging. Because of the issue of global warming and climate change, do you sense that that is what is causing this, that the climate itself is changing?
I think so. We've always had permafrost, and we always had... In the long run, it helped us, you know, the permafrost. It stayed intact and never was a problem to us. It provided for keeping our subsistence food, you know, preserved and more readily able for us to use our own subsistence food that we traditionally use them. Now we have to try to beat the warmer climate. We have to work on our bittered seals in a different fashion. We have to kind of make them faster, and a learning experience for us. Sometimes it's so warm that sometimes we don't have our food done properly because of the heat used to being cold.
Yeah, the permafrost is a huge issue, because in the past the ground was literally frozen all the time. That's why it's called permafrost, obviously. Because of the climate change, the ground is softening, and therefore homes don't have the same foundation. And that's also, that besides just the storms, it's this issue of the permafrost also, isn't it?
Yep. It just melts with the sand just melts with the ocean.
Yeah.
The water.
Well, here's a question. Now, when you think back, I grew up in Minnesota, which is possibly almost as difficult as Shishmaref at many times because of the snow and the cold and the winters and 30 below and 40 below and 60 below. So I can understand what it's like to experience winter. But when I talk with people from Minnesota, they say the winters aren't as difficult as they used to be. It doesn't get as cold. It doesn't get as cold for so long, and it seems as if spring is coming earlier and winter seems to come later. When you think back to your memories as a child, for example, can you sense that there has been a shift in those dynamics, the cold, the winter, the coming of spring?
Yes, there's a definite shift in the cold. By November, we used to have the ocean frozen by then, and nowadays it barely freezes until before Christmas.
And that's a dramatic change. Tell me more about what you noticed, what you personally have experienced in terms of those changes.
We had to learn to make adjustments on how we do our subsistence and when to keep warm, and majority of it is our subsistence foods. We have to learn the new warmer climate.
That will have to change even if you head to the mainland. So your lifestyle is going to be impacted by this. Were you able to kind of store your food outdoors in some sort of structures to keep them throughout the winter and into the summer?
Yeah, we used to do that, and now we have freezers. So, But our main concern is that we here in Shishmaref would like to stay together, and wherever we move, together.
How would you actually make that move? Would you just would you sense that the village would make that decision and move sort of all at once, or would you start a building process and move a few people at a time?
I don't know how it's going to be, but they're doing wind studies, and the wind studies are completed because they're going to use the SHMAP studies done prior years to make an airport up there. And we have one lonely mountain that's close by, and we'll be using the gravel from that to kind of provide a road from that mountain to the relocation site, and then continue to use our gravel to make roads to the edge of the land, and then hopefully we'll be able to move our people somehow.
I'm just curious too. Is there, once you relocate to the mainland, and I believe that that is something that you really believe you have to do, is there a road that connects to your village, or do you have to rely on airplanes to bring in supplies and things?
That's all we do, is wait for airplanes, and sometimes in the summertime we have barges that bring in fuel, mostly fuel and gas.
You really are running a balance between reliance on the sea to provide you with the food, and then as well that which comes in by airplane. So I suppose, therefore, the move has to be preceded by the airport, as you say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is interesting because a lot of people are talking about global warming, and it's seen as and perceived as a huge, almost a threat to humanity. But I've always said I do believe that when people are faced with these dangers, they will figure out a way to accommodate. You know, they won't just, you know, stand and let the storms take them out. And that's what you're doing.
Yes.
It's very, very interesting.
Thank you.
In terms of the world, how do you want them to see you? And as well, is there anything that you can do, or do you wish to kind of handle this on your own?
We accept any kind of assistance that anyone offers us to make sure that we relocate all our people in one site. And that's how we want to be, is remain together as Shishma.
What types of things do you feel would be most useful to you?
Our main concern is that we stay together and not be dispersed to other villages or other towns, because we've seen that happen in Nome, when a village had to be moved to Nome, and they're kind of put on one side of the city, and they continue their own subsistence, but they're kind of not really home.
Well, I totally understand what you're saying, that I believe that it's wonderful that people have such a diversity of lifestyles, and some people interpret that in different ways, but the truth is they all have extraordinary value and significance and the right to continue to exist. Some people may not understand that, but I totally support your desires to maintain. And if you were integrated, for example, into a larger city, your way of life and your people would totally change, and you know that, don't you?
Yes, we've seen it. So
yes, well,
and
we listen
to our elders, and they want to remain Chishma.
Well, I wish you extraordinary success. I wish I knew how better to serve you. Are you getting help then from the U.S. government or others in terms of this process of relocation? How are you being assisted?
We have some help through some agencies that are able to provide the assistance, like soil studies.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some agencies that have to provide for some of the needs that we will need at the new site. Hopefully everything will come into play and we'll be able to move our people soon.
I have to imagine a lot of this would just depend on money as well, finances.
That you can discuss with our main personnel that handles that. I'm just a chairperson for the coalition.
Okay, very fine. I wish you the greatest success. Maybe someday, if I'm lucky, I'll be able to come up and visit Shishmaref and with your people. I so honor your efforts to keep your traditions alive. I think as globalization tries to wash away all of these unique qualities of people and turn them into sort of one generic style of society, I'm totally opposed to that, because I believe that in the diversity we can all survive better. And you're a living example of that, but now being really challenged by, the strangely enough, the effects of globalization.
Yes.
We're talking with Lucy Iningawak from Shishmaref. Lucy, I want to thank you so much and wish you a great success, and hopefully you won't have any bad storms this season.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye.
And does it even matter if I sing? If I sing, if I sink or swim.
The truth is, we are playing games with the truth. Because I follow in the footsteps of Mr. Wizard, I try not to be alarmist. But at the same time, real science says that we are throwing off the balance of life on Earth. It's a cosmic experiment in wonder gone wrong. We have the power to make it right. Do the right thing. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or anytime on the archives when your voice of the Earth will bring you the latest and most important stories on Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give?